We're back. Hour two. About 15 minutes in. And Tony Black for the first time in the new year. Tony, happy new year.
Happy new year to you, Steve. I was listening today. I didn't get a chance because I'm doing a lot of running around here with the kids out of school and everything. I wasn't listening much this week. I heard you say you were going to ask me what I was listening to this week. Well, I got to be honest with you. I missed
That's all right.
your programming. But I was listening today, and I'd read the article on Katie and Trevor McCarthy.
Yeah.
And you know, it's kind of ridiculous when I think about the whole thing, you know, because they now are married and living together. There's been so many situations, like you had mentioned, the brothers, the Ortiz brothers. How about the jocks that aren't married, but they cohabitate, and they're common law. And it just doesn't seem like it even addresses any issue that would create a situation of the sport not having integrity. I mean, I lived with jocks over the years, when, especially when we were kids and single. And I lived with Vince Bracali for a year or so, and the same. We cohabitated because we were sharing the expensive rent, and we lived in Merlin together. And there's been other situations, fathers and sons, Carlos and Eric and David Lopez, you know, father and son, how close can you, can't be much closer than that. And it doesn't affect the integrity of the sport because a father lives with his son, or brothers, Eric and David live together, Lopez. It just doesn't seem like it's a situation that has to even be brought out to light because of you being married or your father's son or whatever. I mean, this sport has integrity, and people have integrity in this sport. And it just puts out there the idea that, well, if you live together or if you're married or if you're father and son, you don't have any integrity. And that's not true. That's no, you know, it's just ridiculous.
Silly.
That yeah. It's silly. It really is. You know, people who have integrity, or if they don't have any integrity or credibility, it's not because they're living or they're not living together. You know, it's silly. It really is.
Yeah, and as I said with Dick, it kind of pops up out of nowhere that, you know, yeah. something that's laying there, you know, kind of quietly on the books that nobody's even thought about. And it actually, that does, you know what, I'm going to write that down. It does beg the question. This is a question for Ed Martin at RCI. Here, I'm going to write this down. Ed Martin, how often do regulators literally go through the book, the rule book, and review and try to, you know, source out and suss out, you know, things like this that could be extricated and avoid a problem somewhere along the way? It seems like that's a worthwhile exercise every, I don't know, every 2 years. Or frankly, you would think that if you did it once, if you just did a review process one time, you'd probably take a few, you know, hidden roadblocks out of the way.
Yeah, that you're totally right on when you make that statement. You know, maybe there are things that have to be addressed in this sport that have bearing on integrity and credibility. But let's deal with the real things, not this silly situation about you know, coupling entries because someone's married, or we're racing for purse only. You know, and they're not allowing the public to bet on.
It hurts everybody.
Yeah,
it hurts everybody. It's
you really like the horse, and oh well, geez, we really like this horse.
Yep.
We're going to bet on him, but oh, this is a couple entry, and it's for wagering. It's for purse only, no wagering, purse only. Give me a break. You know, it's just ridiculous. It's silly.
The other, you know, Tony, the one of the things I was hinting about earlier in the week, had the opportunity to have Don Brumfield join us to pay. We wanted sorry, the conversation was actually it surprised me, Casey. We had Don Brumfield on to talk about David Kassin, and they, you know, how close they were, and then Chuck Baltazar called in, and back of my mind, I said, I wondered if you had had, you know, if you had overlapped at all, because he.
Yeah, I wished I would have been aware of those two riders interviewing and calling in. And of course, Donnie was so close with David Kassin, and you know, and I rode a lot with Chuck when he was in Maryland, and in the, I guess it was the mid-70s, and I rode with Donnie over the years, and I'll never forget a particular instance that I had, and with Donnie, him and I rode an entry 1 year, and what was it? And it was in Maryland. We were riding in Monmouth Park. But anyway, we were on this entry. He was on Coraggioso, and I was on man, I know the horse, and I can't think. It was a horse for Ron Cartwright. I can't think of the name of the horse. But Coraggioso was an outstanding part of the entry, and I was on a horse that won some stakes. But, you know, she wasn't the strongest part of the entry. And before we were in the jocks room, he says, "Hey, Tone," he says, you wanna split in this spot?" And I'm thinking, "Donnie, that's up to you. You the horse you're on has won like 7 or 8 in a row, and I won a couple, you know, weak stakes on this horse." I says, "Whatever you want to do, Donnie, it's fine. You know, you're the controlling entity in this spot. You're the strong part of this entry. Extreme, and out, you know, it was just not even a question who was the most outstanding part of the entry." So he says, "All right, I just wanted to ask you." So anyway, I finished third in the race. He won the race. And a couple weeks go by, and I get a check from the bookkeeper for half of the jock's mount winning purse. You know, and I said,
"Oh, nice! Hey, that's really nice."
Boot was such—he's such a class act. I mean, I didn't even come out and say, "Oh yeah, let's split," you know. And I get the check in the mail, and I thought, man, what a class act.
You know, that's really that I'm glad you that's great. How often, Tony, how often is that up to you? I mean, how does that happen with you guys when it comes to that kind of a situation? How often does that occur?
You know, it probably occurs on and off. As much as it doesn't occur, it occurs. You know, this was it was Bwamazon Farm that had the horses. You know, we both were riding for horses for Bwamazon Farm. But usually it's just something that, you know, jocks will discuss, you know, once in a while. It used to be more, I think, of a discussion in those days. You know, it was just a fair way of doing things if you were on equal parts of the race. And, you know, you're out there, you're riding, let's say, two horses for Bwamazon Farm, right? And, you know, you don't want to interfere with each other's chances, but, you know, you just want to make sure that one person isn't slighted or the other jock isn't slighted. And they might say, "Yeah, you want to split stakes." Maybe at one point you can even at times it could be to each other's advantage to be out there and riding for each other, not against each other. You know, it's a courtesy, or it's something that did exist. You know, you're out there, you want to ensure that your owner and your, if it's two separate trainers, but your own, which it was at that time, it's two separate trainers, but it was Bwamazon Farm. And you want to ensure that you don't impede or in any way hurt each other's chances of winning. But this was one of those deals when it came to Donnie. His horse was outstanding. I mean, and mine was just in it because she had a shot, but it wasn't a shot like what Donnie had on the on Coraggioso. That was the name of the horse, Coraggioso. And but it occurs in this day and age, but it occurred more commonly, I think, in the early years of my career. You know, this was in, I guess, in the 70s, 80s. I forget the years. You know, it all runs together. You've been out there as many years as I was out there. You lose track of the exact year. You know, 10 years don't make much of a difference anymore. Oh, it happened in the 70s or it happened in the 80s? Or did it happen in the 80s or did it happen in the 90s? It's hard to figure sometimes and keep track of all those minor details. But the one thing that wasn't a minor detail, I couldn't believe it when the bookkeeper sent me a check and it was for half of the winning.
That's great. That really is. I'm glad you told that story.
What a class act, Donnie Brumfield. Boot. He was a good guy. In fact, we even had the same valet in Jersey, in the old valet, Tony DeLitto. He was just a tough old cookie, you know, in old valet with that rode years ago in the 20s or 30s or whatever. And then he had Boot and me in the same corner. And he could tell me, you better just don't watch the way he rides. Watch the way he acts. Watch how much class he displays as not just a jockey, but as a human being. So, I really admired guys like Boot, and they were held up as an example of not just how to ride horses, but how to conduct yourself as a person and how to conduct yourself in life.
Tony, in addition to that fun moment that we had, particularly with Chuck calling in, and He made me laugh because I said, you know, when did you retire? He goes, I'm not retired. I'm training cutting horses. So, you know, these guys stay at it as long as they're upright. They're going to keep at it. I do have to also fold in from Monday another, you know, big Philadelphia connection, and I can only speculate of your 5,000 wins, how many Keith Jones called. We had Keith on to say thank you and au revoir to him. He's off to Texas, the Houston area, north of Houston. But we had a really fun visit with Keith. You might enjoy when you get a chance on the archives.
I'm definitely going to listen to it because I'll never forget Keith Jones. I heard his voice for so many years, and he replaced Jack Lamar, I believe it was, when Keystone.
Yes.
And it went from Jack Lamar to Keith Jones. But I'll never forget his call to one of my last rides. And I said, listen, Keith, before the race, I said, this horse wins. And it was my 52nd 100. It'll be my 52nd 100 win. And that's probably going, that's it, Keith. You know, 5,200. And it was on a horse that my son owned, Smart Tory, I think her name was, Smart Tory. So when the horse won, you know, he announced, and the way he did it, he really tickles me because I told him, this probably be my last win, my last ride. I'm done after today. He says in the announcement, you may just have witnessed the final ride. And the way he said, you may just have witnessed the final ride of Anthony Black on Smart Tory. And it was a few months later, I think, I rode another few races, and I won on Winning Image and some other horses, some stakes. But I thought, boy, was he pretty sharp. He knew Tony Black. You know, and where did I get this this mentality of you kind of hang in there even after you say you're done? And I guess I inherited it from guys like you were just saying, Chuck Baltazar, and guys that say, you never want to say you're done. You know, I'm done, you know. The only thing I quit in my life that was totally quitting was alcohol and drugs. You know, I quit that. But I never said I was going to totally quit horse racing. You know, you don't quit it. You don't retire from it. It's in your blood. You're addicted to it. And you kind of love the sport in a way that you're never going to just want to be saying I walked away from it. And you know, I even made a mention to someone that said, oh, they criticize what I do. And I thought, well, you know what? I am happy with the career I had. And there have been jockeys that weren't fortunate as I was to ride 34,000 races and walk away from it. I have someone in my family that's paraplegic, I walked away from it, but I'm never totally out of it. I enjoy going out there and getting on horses in the morning. When the kids get back in school, I'll be going out again. I haven't been getting on horses for a few months because I'm home with the kids. You know, they're not in school. When they go back to Richie Vega or Dandy or a few of these guys that I've enjoyed being around.
Did we lose Case?
But
did we lose?
Never get totally walk away from.
We lose Tony.
Sport.
That was strange.
As much an addiction as
kind of a fade
in my life, an addiction.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.
From BRL Equine, the people that bring you EPO Equine, Unlock, and Bleeder Shield, now comes Flexify HA, the most advanced scientifically based joint supplement on the market. To find out more, contact me, Joseph Vellante, at 215-501-6880. To be the best, give them only the best. BRL Equine.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
To At the Races with Steve Bick on SiriusXM Radio.
Are you still there?
There he is. That was that was me that got disconnected. I was saying, Tony, did we lose you? But I guess it was me that that lost the tie to Florida. Tony, you still there? No? No, Tony? I guess that's a no to Tony. Okay. All right. Well, we got most of it in. I wanted to ask him about Keith and the conversation with I knew that, you know, he had spent time with Chuck Baltazar and Don Brumfield, because he's talked about it before. How about that? You know, that's something that I don't think maybe the general public is that aware that, you know, jocks in an entry, you know, basically splitting the pot, you know, wherever you finish, wherever I finish. And that way, you know, everybody's you know, motivated and equally rewarded. But that's classy what Don Brumfield did without Tony, you know, necessarily saying, yeah, sure, I'll split with you. That's pretty cool. I don't think that's ever, I can't remember that ever coming up before in over the years. Well, speaking of coming up, I think we've got Steve Haskin coming up. Do we or not? No? That sounded like Steve rustling papers in the background. Okay. Get Steve involved. And in the meantime here, let me slip in. What else can I slip in? Yesterday afternoon, the release on the Media Eclipse front, the first issuing of Eclipse recipients. You know, soon we'll get awards of merit announcements that might come as soon as today. Actually, a remarkable achievement by Natalie Voss, who does tremendous work at Pollack Report. She does something that had not been done since the 90s, a remarkable accomplishment. And she wins on both sides of the writing aisle, the feature slash commentary and the news side of things. The news pieces that she wrote were that multi-part series, and it's funny, the dates on Eclipse stuff like this, it's actually, it's not the calendar year, it's November basically to November, and she had done a three-part aftercare series that was really, extensively researched really terrific. And it goes back, it went back to early December of 2019. And then there was also the feature piece that she wrote. So congratulations to Natalie on sweeping both sides of the writing. On the television front, another NBC Breeders' Cup live programming victory. And Billy Matthews, they list Billy Matthews and Lindsay Shanzer as producers, and Lindsay Shanzer, I'm going to assume, is Ken Shanzer's daughter, I'm guessing. And of course, Ken, longtime executive of NBC Sports, and he's actually involved in the HISA Blue Ribbon panel. On the feature side, the Hennigan brothers with their Riders Up piece about the jocks and them being in the sports bubble, and it's funny because I had seen John Hennigan at Breeders' Cup, and so we'll probably have to talk to John about it. And congratulations to them. And and then one that's very personal and special to me, Joe Bianca. And Joe, I've known Joe since he was a teenager, and became friendly off of originally the old ESPN chat board, and then I started Derby Trail, and then Joe came up to Saratoga, started working for us, spent summers with us here and working on the Carolina barbecue team, and then his time at LIU, and then joining TDN. And Joe wrote and had a video tie-in that was in the TDN around the time of Belmont, and it was really special. And you could tell when you listen to Joe's narrating of the video, and in the written side, how personal it is to him, and being from Brooklyn. And it's called To Hell and Back, Belmont Marks a Deserved Triumph for New York City. And the focus was being the first major sporting event in New York Metro in the teeth of the pandemic. And of course, at the time, New York was really the epicenter, and things were devastating. So just so thrilled for Joe. And he, of course, was, shocked and thrilled himself. And also Alex Evers, congratulations to Alex, who won the photography piece. And if you didn't see the picture yet, it's from the first turn, and it's that traditional first turn photograph of the horses, passing the wire for the first time and coming around. And it's always a dramatic photo, except this is dramatic because the building's virtually empty. It pretty evocative, obviously. So congratulations to everybody that was announced yesterday as Eclipse winners. And speaking of such, Steve Haskin. Good morning. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Steve. How are you?
Good. Good. Rolling along already. 4 days into the new year. How was the holiday?
Holiday was wonderful. Especially year like this, you really appreciate it. You know, you think of all the families that were not able to get together. You know, if they were still living in Nebraska, God knows when I would have seen them and Theo last, and certainly not over the holidays. And, you know, I feel for all the people that were not able to get together with families who lived far apart. So, thankfully, it's a three-hour drive, and Joan's brother and sister came, you know, from Boston and Vermont. They only have an hour-and-a-half drive, so the whole family was able to get together. That's what made it special at a time like this. You know, you appreciate every minute you could get with family, and it was just great because this is, you know, this is the first, this is Theo's third Christmas, but it's the first he really can appreciate it and know what gifts are and have it. They had a big tree and, you know, the stockings and the mantle by the fireplace. You know, it was traditional, traditional Christmas, which usually is at our house, but it was much more convenient to have it there. So it was great. You know, he got his usual ton of presents and had a lot of fun over the weekend. So it was very special for sure.
Yeah,
how
great.
About, how about you?
They're, yeah. Oh, we just had a delightful. I mean, the having you know, Zach and Andrea and the baby together, and then Spencer came up from Brooklyn with his roommate, who's a French girl that typically would have gone home to see her folks for Christmas, but obviously there's no, you know, everybody was grounded. So it was nice to have her. She's lovely, Anya. And we had, you know, everybody kind of bunkered down for like 5 days. And then, you know, as hectic as it is, and I did all the cooking, which was fine by me, and then they left, and everybody, you know, trickles back to, you know, their nests, Rochester and Brooklyn. And, you know, suddenly, you know, Tina and I, you think, oh, okay, you'll be ready for everybody to go. But then they left, and you felt, you know, we felt kind of lonely. I mean, it was so much fun,
that's exactly,
you know, to really do nothing.
Yeah, that's exactly what I told Joan when it was decided that we were going to go there. I said, you know, it's great when they come here. You look forward to it. But it's a big difference when you leave there and you've got a three-hour drive back and you can talk about it and you come, you know, and then you come back home. That's okay. But when it's here and they leave and all of a sudden your house is quiet and empty, it gets really depressing. And, you know, it's been like that every year whenever we have Christmas here. We've had Christmas here for, since Mandy was a baby. We've had Christmas here or at Joan's folks' house, which is what was like 20 minutes from here. So it was a combination of both. But we had Christmas here. And, you know, when everybody leaves, it's just like, oh my God, it's so quiet and dead and just, you know, it's just really depressing. So it was much better this way because you had that 3 hour bridge from there to our house to drive home and think about it and talk about it, you know, and then you get home and you got things to do and stuff like that. So it wasn't quite as bad, but I can understand how you were feeling.
Yeah. And we, after that, we did a lot of household stuff and we did go to Vermont. We had a pretty funny, kind of a wandering, through Vermont. I wanted to go.
We're in Vermont,
Ben. Everywhere. I mean, literally everywhere. We were on our way technically to the Vermont Flannel Company in Woodstock. Tina wanted to get a couple of.
I love Woodstock. We stayed at bed and breakfast there. What a beautiful little town Woodstock is. Woodstock.
It immediately. I could not ever remember going to Woodstock, and I was stunned actually at how, you know, how delightful it was. And, you know, that we'll put that, you know, that to me, it very similar to Manchester and Dorset and, you know, that section we're always around. I mean, I'm going to Bennington this afternoon for a haircut, but, Woodstock was just delightful.
You're driving 2 hours to get a haircut?
2 hours. It's 45 minutes.
I'm thinking of Saratoga, closer. Really, only 45 minutes, okay.
Yeah, it's nothing to go to Bennington. We're in Bennington all the time. I go to Bennington.
Excuse me. I'm thinking 2 hours to Brattleboro. Of course, yeah.
Yeah, Brattleboro. Although it's funny. Well, Brattleboro is only, only from Bennington to Brattleboro. It might only be 23 miles, but it'll take you an hour because you got to go up and down the mountain, down the Molly Stark Trail.
Did you ever pull over and stop at Hogback Mountain and look at the view?
Oh, sure. Listen, when I was a kid, we used to go up there to Hogback when Hogback was still, when you could still ski. And we would go to Sky. That was called Skyline. It's not called Skyline anymore. There's now a pizza brewery joint in there, a brew pub. But it's always fun to go to the Overlook. But when I was a kid, I can't tell you how many times, but that's part of the Vermont charm.
I went skiing in that area. I don't know if you know, it's called Big Bromley.
That's part of the story too. We used to go to Ludlow more often than anywhere else because we would stay in a house that my father's friend, my father worked with a guy named Charlie Stone, and Charlie would give us his house at Okemo. So we would typically, stay in Ludlow, and the house is actually on the mountain on the side of Okemo. So we would ski Okemo most often, Stratton sometimes, and Bromley other times. But I had not been to Ludlow in forever. I'm talking 30 years. We also drove, when you go from Woodstock to back down to Ludlow, you go through Plymouth, which is the home of Calvin Coolidge. And I'd been there once before, to the Coolidge house and that homestead, and that's pretty cool. So we just were meandering all over the place, and I had gotten at some point this past summer, I think at the Dorset Farmers Market, I had gotten a terrific jug of maple syrup from a guy in a little town called Tynmouth, which is south of Rutland. And so I told Tina, if we're going in this direction, let's swing through Tynmouth. And we went by the guy's farm, but he didn't have a retail stand. So we were in the middle of, I'm telling you, you wouldn't have known, you could have been in Wyoming as much as I was in Vermont. I mean, it was nothing but rural. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, no, nothing. I mean, for miles around, pretty funny. So anyway, that was our big adventure.
It's a great area, that part.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, the one time I went to Bromley with two friends, we drove all the way up to Vermont, and we stayed in this little place right near Bromley, and as it turns out, we never went skiing. We woke up that morning. It was like the morning before Christmas, actually. We woke up in the morning, and I put the radio, I had a radio, transistor radio back then. And I put the radio on and I heard the guy say, well, the temperature right now is 28 below zero. so nobody could ski. And my friend had a Ford Pinto. And I said, there's absolutely no way on earth this car is going to start. And, of course, it didn't even make a sound. I mean, he had this little Ford Pinto that actually was so bad that we were driving through Troy. And Troy's got these big hills that you go up.
Yeah.
And his car couldn't make it up the street. Instead of going backwards in Troy. And as it turns out, there's no way you can get it started. And we had to go to the guy who ran the little motor inn or so lodge that we were staying at. He was an Australian who the night before had the flu. And I said, I don't want to bother this guy. And I asked him, I said, we need a jump. Is there any way to, get a jump? The guy came out in his undershirt. And I said, he's just big Australian guy with a beard. He comes out in his undershirt. And I said, wait a second. I mean, no human being would do that in a million years, especially one who had the flu the night before. Because I knew he had the flu because I went in and asked him for an extra pillow. And he gave us a jump. And the car made it to Springfield, Massachusetts, and then it died again on Christmas Day. We had to try and look for somebody to fix his car or give him another jump or so. Well, it was an absolute nightmare. So that was my experience at Bromley.
That's a fun story.
You talk about Calvin Coolidge's home, by the way. I take it one of my favorite homes. You talk about Manchester. I'm sure you've been to Mary Todd Lincoln's home there.
Sure.
Beautiful, beautiful. You go out in the back with the mountains on both sides.
Hildene.
You had the Green Mountains on one side and another mountain range on the other side. You're right. Oh, it's absolutely gorgeous there. Yeah,
Hildene.
It's a good travelogue for everybody listening in case you're up in Vermont.
Oh, there's I know you usually go at least once a summer when you come up, but there's been a lot of new there's a lot of new hotels in Manchester that have been built.
Well, you got that big fancy one, of course, obviously.
Well, the Equinox, but
the Equinox Hotel next to the mountain. If anybody's ever in Manchester, by the way, drive up to the top of Equinox Mountain if you want to see a view.
Yeah, Equinox is fun. In fact, it's funny. Tina and I, at some point during when things were really restricted, when nobody was doing anything, so this might have been May, June, or before the track opened, might have been July. We had to go to We went to Manchester one afternoon, and we went to our friend who has the he blows glass, Manchester Hot Glass. And he's got a website if anybody's looking for wonderful, unique gifts, Manchester Hot Glass. And I had never seen so many cars lined up to go up the road up to Equinox, up to the top of the mountain. There must have been 25 cars lined up. It was the craziest thing I've ever seen. Tina and we looked at each other like, this is nuts. And it made sense, though, because it was something people could do, without having to worry about distancing. You go up to the top and you could walk around and people could stay distant easily. But I'd never seen so many cars lined up to go up the road, hill.
That's wild.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was nuts. There was also right on the road that takes you from Cambridge to Arlington, which is the road from New York into Vermont. There's a kind of a turnoff where there must be room for 15, 20 cars to park. And it's where a lot of people will put their kayak or their canoe or their tubes, their inner tubes, into the Battenkill to go floating. Or to fish. They were parked for a half a mile in either direction. There must have been 200 cars. And again, this was something when, there was nothing for anybody to do. It was wild. I got a picture of it, actually. Tina and I were like, this is crazy what was going on. We tried to go to the west side or the eastern shore of Lake George. There's a walking trail. And we thought to ourselves, this again must have been in the early summer. And we said, let's go. We're not big hikers. We're not from the hikers, as it were. But we thought, let's go. This would be fun. We couldn't do it because the police had cut off access to the parking lot. There were so many people doing it. It was wild. The alternate activities. I give people credit for. for coming up with alternate activities.
Yeah, I guess so.
Steve, let's shift gears.
You talk about Bennington. For all those that don't know it, the greatest attraction in Bennington is now long gone. Was Green Mountain? Well, it's not as long gone as we know it, but Green Mountain Racetrack.
A panel.
Most racing fans now probably never even heard of it, or certainly don't remember it. But yeah, I actually was there.
I actually
had the distinction of betting on a 50-1 shot that I loved. I looked at him. I said, wait a second. This was 50-1. Couldn't believe it. I bet on him. He was 50-1. And I went to the apron to watch the race. And I looked up the tote board. He was 5-2. that was Green Mountain for you.
Well, we go by it, not as often. Actually, not as often as we used to, but it's actually in Pownall. And the only racing I actually saw there was when the Greyhounds were there.
Right.
And we went for Dr. John Cheros, Pont Street Stables. And John, they were running at Aqueduct. And so John and I drove. His house is, he's got a house near Stratton in Jamaica, Vermont. And we drove down to Pownall. And the dogs were running. So we bet some puppies. And... We bet I want to say it was Tap the Admiral that was running. And that was the one time I got to see live racing of any kind, because there was dogs, there was harness, and there was thoroughbreds.
It's funny, the racetracks that, you know, you knew very well back then that no longer exist, and people never heard of, like, you know, Green Mountain. People don't realize that there was a racetrack in Maine, Scarborough Downs. That
just closed. Just closed last month, last week, 2 weeks ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They had their last race right before Christmas.
Scarborough Downs?
Yep.
What did they race there?
Harness.
Oh, harness. Oh, okay.
For years.
Oh, okay. I remember... You remember Shenandoah Downs in West Virginia?
I know the name. That's an early one. We had one mentioned yesterday. Rick Mocklin was on us. He called races at Jefferson Downs.
Oh yeah. Well, listen to that. Jefferson Downs was where John Henry got his start.
How about that? That's a good trivia question. Well, and speaking,
Shenandoah Downs was as cheap as you can get. And back in the 70s, there was a horse that came up. Oh, God, I'm drawing a blank on his name. It starts with an A. I think it started with an A. Oh, God, it's right on the tip of my tongue. Anyway, this horse came to New York. He came to Saratoga from Shenandoah Downs, and he won the Hopeful. And the favorite race was a Phipps horse.
And he won the Hopeful? Who are we talking about?
What's that?
I want to find him. You got me intrigued.
It was unbelievable. From Shenandoah Downs, which may have been the cheap, maybe as cheap a racetrack as there was in the country. Nobody ever came up from Shenandoah Downs ever.
What era, Steve? How far back?
I'm going to say in the early 70s.
Interesting. I'm looking for an offbeat.
Go on Google.
No, I got the Hopeful in front of me.
Go back in the early 70s.
Gusty O'Shea?
That's the horse, Gusty O'Shea. Gusty O'Shea.
That's great. God, it's a great name.
Gusty O'Shea. I mean, he was like, at the time, it was like unheard of. Gusty O'Shea.
Trained by Harry Johnson and ridden by Bob Kotenko.
Yeah, he actually was a fast horse. He had actually run at Saratoga before that. He ran in the Sanford or the Saratoga Special or so, and he actually did okay. And he came and he beat this the Ogden Phipps horse gets beat by a horse from Shenandoah Downs in the Hopeful Stakes.
And I'm just gonna, because I've got it right here. You never know what crazy. And I'll have to use newspapers.com to find the write up on it. But here, let me
that
pull
was
up.
A great story. It was a great story. What was that?
That's
like,
a natural.
72, was that 71, 72?
73.
73. Okay.
73.
Right.
Well, actually, and you're helping me. You're going to help me make it easier to shift gears
That's interesting, by the way. 73. If you look at the history of the Hopeful Stakes, by the way, you'll see a horse from Shenandoah Downs wins it in 73, and the year before it was won by Secretariat.
Exactly. Well, now this is the second day in a row where we've run into a situation that because of the earnings, it's not in the American Racing Manual.
Really?
Yeah, anything under $100,000, it had to be a purse of $100,000 or more.
That. That's right. I remember that. They had that crazy restriction.
Yeah, which is too bad.
If you didn't earn enough money, you did not exist in the American Racing
exactly.
Manual.
Exactly. That is too. I'll find something on it, Steve. Since we went in this direction, I did want before it gets too far in the rearview mirror. And Michael Blowen may be with us as early as tomorrow, but if not next week, because I talked to Michael over the holiday. Riff a couple of minutes. We didn't get a chance for you to talk about Congaree before the holiday break, but talk about Will's Way, because I mentioned
I actually
this
did
morning
talk about Congaree.
We did talk? Okay, I couldn't remember.
Yeah.
But Will's way, you know, he didn't have the a long career or you know, have a you know, the kind of resume that that makes, you know, younger people that come to the game as aware as some of the horses he ran against, like Skipaway. But he was part of a couple of years of just incredible competition.
Yeah, he was a tough little guy, I'll tell you. But yeah, the thing about Will's way, and people love to talk about rivalries, and they look, you know, you look at two horse rivalries, and once in a blue moon you'll get a three horse rivalry, but you know, not often, especially not horses that are that equal. But when he was a 4 year old, Will's way, I always remember this. I always keep this off the top of my head. By the way, he ran in four major stakes races. He ran in the Mass Cap, the Suburban, the Whitney, and the Woodward. In those four races, these were the top three finishes. In the Mass Cap, it was Skipaway, Formal Gold, and Will's Way. In the Suburban, Skipaway, Will's Way, Formal Gold. In the Whitney, Will's Way, Formal Gold, Skipaway. In the Woodward, Formal Gold, Skipaway, Will's Way. I mean, where did you ever see anything like that? I mean, these three horses, every single race, would ding-dong it and take turns beating each other. And unfortunately, that last race in the Woodward, where Formal Gold just blew the doors off of Skipaway, and Will's Way was right behind Skipaway in third, but he had suffered, I remember he suffered a fracture in that race, and he had to be retired because he was making a winning move in that race. And Formal Gold, I remember, had taken the lead from Skipaway, which was very rare, but he was so sharp then. And Shane Sellers was on Skipaway and just sort of let him open up. And he just went out there and just kept going. And Will's Way made actually a nice move in that race. And he just, all of a sudden, he just stopped running. And he didn't run badly. He was third. And he probably got beat like maybe five, six lengths. But you could see something happened in the race. And then I don't know if he fractured a knee or something like that, but he suffered some kind of a fracture in that race. But he was a tough horse. And as a three-year-old, you know, before Formal Gold really got good, was just starting to get good. But Will's Way was still running against Skipaway, and you throw in Louis Couture's in there, and they had run 1, 2, 3 in the Travers, and I believe Louis Couture's just beat Will's Way in the Jim Dandy. I mean, there were a lot of good horses. And the funny thing is, I remember distinctly about Will's Way going into the Breeders' Cup. He had run after the Travers, after he won the Travers, he had gone up to the Super Derby, and he ran terribly. It was the first time he had ever run poorly in his life. And as it turns out, he came out of the race, and like for 5 days after the race, he was coughing, and he was not doing well. Because after the race, I remember talking to Jim Bond, and he said that the Breeders' Cup is hit, because I was covering the Classic for the Racing Forum back then. And I remember Jim Bond saying, Breeders' Cup history. No way we're going. And then, like, after, like, 5 days when the horse stopped coughing, I remember he was galloping, and he was like a tiger. And the exercise rider couldn't even hold him. So I remember when Jim said, well, you know, let's work him and see what he does. So they worked him 7 furlongs, and he wound up going 7 furlongs in 125 and change, and he wound up galloping out like a mile and a quarter in like 203. And they decided, well, okay, what we're going to do now is that, you know, just, you know, you never know. You know, Cigar was obviously the big horse, and Skipaway was going. As it turns out, Hines has decided not to run him. So, at the last minute, he said, well, you know, let's put up the $40,000 for the fee, and it cost him $7,500 to ship him to Woodbine to work, just to see how he handled the racetrack. If he didn't handle the racetrack, they were going to ship him back. But they wanted to see how he handled the racetrack. And he went up there, and he wound up working a mile in like 139 and change, which doesn't sound like incredibly fast. But I remember the day before, they had run the feature race. The day before was running like 138 and 4. So the track was like really slow, and he worked 139 and change. And he decided to to go in the race. And but it turns out he got shuffled way in the back of the pack, and he didn't run very well. And it was a classic case of trainers always say, "Oh, well, I listen to my horse." Horses lie quite a bit, and his initial thoughts of skipping the Breeders' Cup was right. You know, the horse was coughing; he was not quite himself. But this horse was so energetic; he was a little fireball, and the fact that he gave him these false signs. Well, maybe they weren't false, but the fact that the way he galloped and then the way he worked, then he goes up to Canada and works a mile. He said, "All right, the horse is doing great," but you just never know. Sometimes the horses will fool you, and they will lie to you to tell you. You know, it's like a football player who's got a concussion. He says, "Well, forget it. I'm playing, no matter what." You gotta say, "No, you're not playing." You gotta hide his helmet so for him not to go out there to play with a concussion. Sometimes it's the same way with horses. Horses say, "No, I want to run in this race," and you don't want to, but they make you run, and then you don't run very well, and you feel like an idiot. But that's why he. The only two blemishes on his record were those two, the Super Derby where he came out with the cough and the Breeders' Cup Classic where he probably shouldn't have run. But then at a 4-year-old he was terrific again, and that Whitney was an amazing race, by the way. Him and Formal Gold just battled to the wire. It's a great year, like you said, there was a lot of good horses out there. Lucas had Editor's Note, who had won the Belmont Stakes, and it was a very good year.
The quality, and I'm just I had it here, and now of course it's missing.
People forget also, by the way, Louis Couture's. People don't even remember this, by the way. That when Alphabet Soup beat Cigar, everybody thinks, "Oh yeah, Alphabet beat Cigar." But you don't realize that Louis Couture was second in that race, beating the nose. So, I mean, those 3-year-olds were really good 3-year-olds. And I'm sure Will's Way would have run much better, you know, had he probably been himself. But you know, that was like the nose loss in the Breeders' Cup that nobody ever paid any attention to. It was all about Cigar getting beat and being upset by Alphabet Soup. But Louis Couture snuck in between the two of them, by the way. He was just right on the rail and just missed by a nose, and nobody noticed.
Now the Travers, and that was during a period where there were it continued on, you know, it's 25 years now, but there's been so many good tight Travers finishes, and I was coming down, I was coming down from Montreal, 3, 4, 5 weekends a summer, this was really the period that I, became pretty engaged and captivated by the game, and he was one of the ones.
Will's Way, was at Old Friends up at Saratoga forever. I mean, he was like one of the, he might have been the first horse there.
Could be.
When they opened up that farm, I mean, God, I remember seeing him Cabin Creek, right? That's the name?
Yes.
Cabin Creek.
Yes. Yeah.
God, I remember seeing him. It seemed like it was like 20 years ago I saw him. I mean, he was there a long time.
Yeah, I wanted you to. I figured.
I think he was standing at one point. I think he was standing in Pennsylvania at some point.
That sounds right.
Before we went there, he was at, and he retired to one of the bigger farms, but then he wound up in somewhere in Pennsylvania.
Will's Way. We're going to talk to Michael. There's also a fun story that cropped up here in the last week about old friends. We'll do that with Michael maybe as early as tomorrow. Steve, also want to slip in a couple of quick 3-year-old thoughts. Your take on Life Is Good.
You know, a lot of people are going to knock him for that race because, from a visual standpoint, at the eighth pole, you thought this horse was just going to cruise home and went off by himself by six lengths or so. But I really don't hold that race against him. Although he's, you know, the thing is, we're going to go through this again now. These intermischiefs, again, they're coming out of the woodwork. I mean, all these horses that, I mean, there's a horse that I absolutely love, by the way, that Judman has named Mandalown, another intermischief, and there's several others. Every time I look up, I say, oh, another intermischief. I just went through this last year with Authentic. What do you do with these horses? I mean, you just have no idea. But the thing with Life is Good, and the thing I'm gonna people don't realize is that I'm gonna let this race, even though he won the race, people, a lot of people were disappointed in the effort, even though the second horse, Medina Spirit, that Baffert also has, he's always been very high in his horse. And it was a gap of like a million lengths to the third horse, so a really nice horse named Parnelli, who I thought was going to run much better. But there were two things about Life is Good you have to remember. A, 6 days before the race, he worked six furlongs and won 10 and 3. I mean, that is serious work, 6 days before a race for a horse coming out of a maiden race, you know, stretching out to a mile. That's number one. Number two, in that maiden race, he got a thoroughbred for 2 3/4. And that's pretty remarkable for a first-time starter to get a 2 3/4 thoroughbred number. So, yeah, I think there's a little bit of a bounce factor there, you know, coming off a really fast race. And you don't want a horse at this point of his career to be running that fast. So I think taking a little step backwards yet still winning was actually a good thing for him. Because I think he regressed a little bit off that 2 3/4 maiden win, which is, he's not going to find maidens, 2-year-old maidens running 2 3/4, and the fact that he works 1 10 3. I mean, that's still an incredible. If you watch that work too, by the way, the way he did it, he said, this horse is a running machine. So, you know, once again, I think, you know, Baffert's got two serious horses. I don't know how far he wants to go, but the second horse looks like a really good horse too. That Medina Spirit. I think he's going to be a real nice horse. And a lot of people don't know much about his, pedigree, but his pedigree actually is a distance pedigree.
Oh, very
so
much.
I think, he's going to have a horse called Protonico. Most people don't remember, but it's all distance. And he's a really nice horse. But, listen, it's so early to tell whether these horses are Derby horses. And, you know, normally when I do my first Derby rankings, you know, Derby dozen, whatever, which starts January 18th, so I got to start really getting serious now, sorting them out, which I'm trying to do. But I always take the horses, you know, the horses that are established, the essential qualities and the keep me in minds and all these horses that have proven themselves. And these horses coming off maiden wins, I sort of keep them in the background a little bit. But you know what? You can't do that anymore because the Derby's completely changed. I mean, listen, we've seen, you know, we saw Justified. Nobody even heard of him at this point. Nobody even heard of him 2 months from now. So you just don't know. So there are horses right now. I mean, Todd Pletcher has got a horse that won his first start named Prime Factor. From a visual standpoint, it was breathtaking. I mean, it was just like the horse did nothing wrong. Went with his ears pricked. And I love looking at the head-ons to see how these horses run, if they see any stride defects, if they paddle, or how they keep, if they run at an angle. And this horse just kept his legs under him absolutely perfectly. He did everything like a seasoned pro, and he just ran a very, very strong race. And in fact, the horse that ran second to him was another Pletcher horse who's running Saturday at Gulfstream, going a mile. Watch out for this horse. Pletcher's got five horses running on Saturday, 5 3-year-olds, maidens running on Saturday, and Chad Brown's got four. So keep an eye on these three maiden races. One is a mile, two are 6 furlongs. There's a lot of really expensive horses and well-bred horses. But anyway, one of the horses running in that mile race is the horse that ran second to him named Bracken. Keep an eye on that horse. I would be very disappointed if he didn't run well. Because while Prime Factor was right on the lead, or stalking the lead the whole way and drew off easily, this horse came from way back. You don't see Pletcher horses normally come from that far back. But I love the looks of this horse. He's got the look of a distance horse. He's bred to go long. He's owned by the Lowe's. He just got a look about him. And I like the way he closed in the race. He closed to get second in there. And I think he's going to love it, absolutely love it, when the distance stretch out. So now stretching out from that race, now going a mile, I'm really curious to see how he does. So watch out for his horse, Bracken. If he runs well Saturday, watch out for him as a serious long range derby horse. And,
nice.
You know, just looking at some, you know, listen, Essential Quality, obviously, you would think would be the logical favorite. But I tell you, a horse, by the way, that I'm going to put him really high up, because I've got a lot of connections with his owner going back a couple of years. But the horse that won the Springboard Mile, the Senor Buscador, man, I'm telling you, this horse has got a move on him. He's got a turn of foot that you don't often see. And I've always been in contact with the owner, Joey Peacock, ever since they had
a runaway ghost
a few years ago. And I'll never forget where I was always in constant contact with him, because I was fascinated by Runaway Ghost, because he had run a monster race in the Riley Allison Futurity, but the way he did it, and he came back and won the Sunland Futurity. I thought he was going to be a legitimate a derby horse. And I'll never forget where I was talking to Joey Peacock, and he was telling me about the mare, you know, Rose's Desert. And they had given up all their horses to concentrate on her, to breed her to all the top stallions. And I remember when this horse was going for the Derby, Rose's Desert was due to fall on April 22nd. I remember the date. Due to fall on April 22nd, in fall to Mineshaft. And we were waiting for it, and waiting, and waiting, and waiting. And she didn't give birth until the day after the Kentucky Derby. It was like May 6th or 7th or whatever it was. It was like the day. So she was like several weeks late. And I always remember that, waiting for this mineshaft, for the Rose's Desert to fold this mineshaft. And here he pops up in this race. And his two races, by the way, I mean, not only does his horse come from far out of it, but he just blew his field away. You know, some nice horses in there. And he wins by six. The way he did it, too, I looked at him and said, this horse is a real pro. And watching the race, one of the great calls, I don't know who the Remington the race caller is, but going down the backstretch, I remember he's saying, and last is Senor Buscador. He says, but we may hear from him later, because he had come from like 15 lengths out of it to break his maiden in his first start. And sure enough, when he hit the turn, wow, it was like he was shot out of a cannon, and he went way, way wide, and he just absolutely demolished that field and drew off. I'm saying, I'm going to put the, with his pedigree, I said, this horse is going to be way, way up there, and in the ranking. So he's definitely a horse that I'm watching. I'm gonna do a little strange thing. I'm not gonna play it safe, you know. All right, Essential Quality, keep me in mind. We all know about them, and they're all legitimate derby horses, but there's a few interesting horses to watch out for, and Senor Buscador was one. They were originally gonna point him for the Lecomte, and they thought it over and they changed their mind. They're gonna wait for the Risen Star. So which means he would go into the Derby off of only four starts, and then with that 6 week layoff that I'm not crazy about. So I mentioned that to him, and he said that he had talked to Todd Fincher about it, and they decided that the way this horse trains that they think they can that shouldn't be a problem. So I think it's good that they're waiting rather than come right back in the Lecomte, to wait for the Risen Star. So we'll see what happens there, but that's a horse I'm really, really following.
Todd Fincher was on with us on Monday.
Yeah,
and
I saw it on the archives. I listened to him.
Yeah, and we were excited. Then he ran second and he won those two stakes at Delta Downs on Tuesday and Wednesday. Dale Day, by the way, is your Remington, is the the race caller at Remington. It's quite good.
Oh, yeah. It was a great line. We may hear from him later. It was a great, great line. I mean, that's I'll never forget that line. But I mean, Kenny Yabusco there right now is at Sam Houston. He had a really good workout, so you don't see too many horses, Derby horses, at Sam Houston. But Todd is all he's all over, Southwest and the Midwest and Texas, and so it'll be interesting to see when he shifts to Fairgrounds what the Derby picture looks like and there is the star, because that's not going to be an easy spot. You saw some of the horses who were at Fairgrounds, like Jackie's Warrior. I mean, there's a lot of good horses right now stapled at Fairgrounds. A lot of big name horses.
Yeah, we're just getting
Essential Quality is there too. I mean, yep. If you're going to run the Fairgrounds, you better be prepared to run against the top 2 year olds from last year.
The other horse, Steve, before we wrap, too, a quick reaction to Harry Weiner and Capo Kane in the Jerome.
It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
From BRL Equine, the people that bring you EPO Equine, Unlock, and Bleeder Shield, now comes Flexify HA, the most advanced scientifically based joint supplement on the market. To find out more, contact me, Joseph Vellante, at 215-501-6880. To be the best, give them only the best. BRL Equine.
It's raw.
It's about getting freaky.
Why, in the past decade,
there's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only 3 states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to...
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
The Races podcast is sponsored by Keelan Select Horse Bet
from Gomez, and I guess as we go from the specifics as we know them into the specifics of what interrupted his career on more than one occasion, and substance abuse and alcoholism, but also Jay redemption a number of times, and when he was at his best, he did things that have not yet been equaled, including the 2007 season, an unbelievable litany of stake wins, leading the country in earnings 4 years in a row, 2 Eclipse Awards. And when you look at who rode him from a training perspective, sought out by the top outfits in the game for the span of his career.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that when he was that he had an immense amount of talent, and was probably the best rider of the era of that decade. He's just a of the 2000s. You know, and he missed all of, I think it was 2002, when he had had problems, even was in jail for a time, and but came back at, I remember Jim Pegram, the jockey agent, was the one who took him under his wing in 2003 when Garrett came back, and within like a year and a half, he was at the top of the game, and then he had that run in the mid to late 2000s that was just you know, 4 straight years of leading the earnings, jockey earnings nationwide, and 2 Eclipse Awards, and could be certainly argued he should have had more during that time. And that's not on him, that's on the voters. And the list of big races that he won, including 13 Breeders' Cup races, is just, I mean, he was a great rider. You know, one of the things I remember about one of the races I think most people remember of recent vintage of big wins was when he won the Breeders' Cup Classic on Blame, beating Zenyatta, that being Zenyatta's only loss, and under the lights of Churchill Downs. I think what people might forget, and I want to remind people in this time, is that, you know, Garrett had a terrible fall on the eve of that Breeders' Cup, and pretty much rode with, I think Ron Anderson can speak to this later when you get him on, but pretty much rode with one arm, not even useful, but got the kind of treatment he needed to at least get out there and do the job, and won a couple of Breeders' Cup races at that cup, including the biggest of them all in the Classic on Blame. You see, had incredible bravery, and it was just really a horrible saga in terms of the ending of all this.
These stories, of course,